This is General Semantics, November 13, 1963. We've been talking about clinical general semantics and referring to various kinds of disorders and approaches to them. Now I want to single out one, and I think you will see, perhaps, to some degree, the differences that it tends to make if you come at the problem with some background in the study of language as behavior, the symbolization process, abstracting, etc., in short, general semantics. I want to begin with a little data, which I think is always a good way to begin, work with a problem. These data are merely meant to point up the fact, which is well known among those who are familiar with the problem, that more boys and girls, more males and females, are involved in the stuttering problem. Notice how I said that, are involved in the problem. If you were to say more boys than girls are stutterers, that would be a very different kind of statement, possibly. At least it would be subject to interpretations that would be very different from what I intend. I don't want to labor these data. They merely illustrate the point. They're taken from various clinics. The one above is for sampling of very young children, from 2 to 8 years old. The one in the middle is from the St. Louis schools and goes through all grades up to high school. The bottom one was taken from the Iowa Speech Clinic files by Shule back in 1947, I think. She pulled about 1,400 stutters folders, and this was the These were the percentages for male and female. The next slide, please, Augie. Now, one of the persistent and pesky problems has been, why is this? Why the sex difference? And all the theories that have been advanced to explain it have been explanations of another fact, of another assumption, I should say. It has been assumed that the data that I just showed you, data like that, it's been assumed that what they mean is that girls are more fluent than boys. Stuttering is defined in the dictionaries as a disorder in the rhythm of verbal expression, in the fluency. And so, to almost everybody, it has meant when there are more boys than girls who are called stutterers, that apparently girls talk more fluently than boys. And so this is what has been explained in various ways, in order to account for the fact that there are more boys than girls involved in the stuttering problem. Well, this kind of explanation went on for years. Now, you see, I want to take time out for a footnote. I'm talking today about a problem, a very specific one, but so many of the things that there are to say about it are to be said about a large number of other problems. And what I am now about to say is to be said of a large number of other problems. We tend to explain things without knowing the facts we're explaining. Over and over again we do this. And here we did it for years and years, explaining why girls talk more fluently than boys. And I can't claim that I was so clever that I saw this. So went out and got some data. That wasn't the way it happened. I got the data, and after we analyzed it, I noticed something. It is that girls are not more fluent than boys. These are data taken. It so happened we were doing some research on how this stuttering problem begins, the onset of stuttering. And we tape recorded speech according to a procedure we use to get the sample. We tape recorded the speech from a pretty large number. It turned out to be 89 children who were regarded by their parents as stutterers. And for each one of those, we had a control child of the same age and sex and socioeconomic level of the family who was not regarded as a stutterer by anyone, who was regarded as a normal speaker. And we analyzed the tapes for disfluencies. I seem to have coined this word. I really didn't know that, but I guess it isn't in the dictionary. We need a word to talk about the hesitations and the repetitions and the revisions and excessive pausings. And so it seemed to me that these should be called disfluencies. And we have several kinds of them, as you see represented here. And when we got done analyzing the tapes, then it became apparent when the data landed on my desk, there are no differences in the fluency. These are supposedly normal children between the ages of roughly 2 and 8, for the most part. 2.5 to 8 and 9. And on these kinds of what we call disfluencies, interjections, that type of thing. There's even a few more for the girls, but those numbers are mathematically the same. They're statistically equivalent, all of them. Let's have the next slide, please. All the repetitions. And here are four more kinds of disfluencies. And again, there are no differences. When you total them all, you do get a few more for the girls, which I think is ironic. It isn't a statistically significant difference. Those two bars are mathematically the same length, statistically the same length. That kind of a difference could be a chance difference. The point is that they're equally disfluent or equally fluent. Now then, this entirely changes the issue. Nobody had ever talked about the sex difference in the so-called incidence of stuttering with the assumption that these were the facts. Now that we know these are the facts, now what do you do? Now what is the problem? What is to be accounted for? What you have here are two groups of speakers, two populations, if you like. And in the one, from 2 to 4 times more get classified as stutterers, but the two groups talk equally fluently. Now, how do you account for that? Always it was assumed before that what you were accounting for was the greater disfluency of the male. There is no such thing to be accounted for, you see. I have the same data for stutterers. And it's the same. I didn't want to take up time to go into all the details. This is the essential fact. Now,
a higher social premium is placed on male speech than on female speech.
Yes. Now, we can have various kinds of hypotheses, and I hope you get the feeling for the difference between a statement like you made and a statement that you could make on the basis of these observations. And you can make lots of statements like this. Some of the statements you make could be tested. You said there are a higher social premium placed on fluency for boys and for girls. Well, you can devise an interview procedure, I suppose, and go out over the land and find out what people tell you, or devise some other way to test your hypothesis. I don't want to take up time here elaborating various possible hypotheses. I hope you'll do that, and when you do it, I hope you will recognize the level of abstracting on which you're talking. So long as you talk about things like this, you're down on a very descriptive level. These are what we would ordinarily call facts. Interpretations are something else again. It does look as though we do have a double standard which begins in the cradle and lasts throughout life. But you take that to your mountaintop and do with it what you will. Let's go on now to the next. I didn't mean for those to... we've already had that. Oh, pardon me. How about you? There are what might be called folk theories. There are abroad in the land patterns of explanation which are used by people who have never read a book. They've never done research of any kind. They've never taken a course in what they are trying to explain. But somehow they have absorbed from the culture, from their mother's knees, from their family dining table, from the corner drugstore, patterns of explanation, the folk theories. And the folk theories regarding a problem such as stuttering are these. Either there is a physical fault, there's something wrong with the throat, there's something wrong with the nervous system, there's something wrong with the body somewhere. Something wrong with the breathing muscle. They say it in all kinds of ways, and it doesn't matter how they say it. They're saying the same thing, and they're saying nothing. In the way of a statement about data. This isn't about data. This is folk thinking. This is the thinking you do when you don't do any thinking about the thinking you do. There's something wrong with the body, we say. Or we say there's something wrong with the, and now the words get very mystical and hard to define, the personality. We say the child is emotionally disturbed. These words are terribly difficult to pin down to something that you can observe with a high degree of reliability. But that doesn't bother the folk. These words are easy to pronounce. Something wrong with the personality, we say. Personality comes out of your mouth as easily as the word body does. And if you don't think much about the language you're using, it doesn't bother you at all to say the word personality. If you do think much about the language you use, you wonder what they say. What do they say? What personality? What's that? But it's a rare person who has that kind of an afterthought. And so we tend to take for granted we're talking about something which we must then explain. And we explain the fault of the body or of the personality as being due either to heredity or to trauma, to a disease, an accident, a great fright. Some trauma, some episode, some calamity. And that is how things are supposed to be caused. This is the folk theory. It has nothing to do with data. It's just that the human mind abhors a vacuum of explanation. And so we have explanations which are the mode, which we are used to. The next slide. Now, scientific theories are something else again. They're derived in an entirely different way. You don't get them at your mother's knee. You work hard for them. You make observations and you try to make sense of them. I put folk theories at the top there, and under scientific theories, see folk theories. By this I mean, there are, after all, scientific theories which are like the folk theories, but they're very different. They were derived from research, from data. There are theories about heredity. There are theories about problems caused by trauma. But they're very, very different from the folk theories. They're reasoned. They're based on good data. The folk theories are not. The folk theories are simply handed down from mother to daughter and father to son in essentially thoughtless fashion. But it sometimes turns out that something like what the folk theories seem to be are good theories, provided you derive them properly. It's true that much of medicine was once folk medicine. But folk medicine is very, very different from scientific medicine, even though you take the same drugs. You take them with a different kind of a rationale and for different reasons and with a different understanding of what you're doing. And so you tend not to kill every 10th patient. Now, the data we have gathered on the stuttering problem has been to date best, I think, summarized or explained in terms of theories of this kind, that the behavior of the speaker involved in the problem is learned. It is behavior. It is not a disorder. Mm-hmm. This is not a sort of a deterioration of the human nervous functions. This is not a disorder. This is something the stutterer does. He learns to do it under conditions which are suitable for that to be learned and which provide reinforcement for those actions that are learned. It is an interaction that is involved here between the speaker and the listener, and in each of these parties or members of the problem, there is an interaction within the person behaviorally. There is an interaction between the way the person thinks and the way he feels and the way he acts. There is an interaction among what we try to designate by the chapter headings in an elementary psychology textbook. There's an interaction between emotion and action, etc. And there's an interaction between and among the persons involved in the problem. So there's an interaction behaviorally and there's an interaction socially. And there is a semantic aspect to this in a very obvious sense, in that the talking that the speaker does about the talking he does is important. It is that interacts with the talking he does. The way he talks to himself about the talking he does to others interacts with what he does when he talks to others. He is essentially giving himself self-instructions, and he is reminding himself of assumptions he makes about what he has to do in order to talk. And these assumptions he has learned, essentially inadvertently, in a kind of a, with the exercise of a sort of faulty logic. We learn a great many causal assumptions because of a temporal association between events. An Eskimo carries a whalebone when he goes hunting one day to take it over to the neighbor, and that day he has a good hunting bag. Forever after, he may carry a whalebone when he goes hunting. This kind of reasoning we all do a good deal of. If a speaker who has been classified as a stutter and has interacted with the listeners who regard him this way, and so he has become somewhat hesitant in talking to them and careful, and he finds that when he wets the lips before he says his name, if only once he does this and then he says his name, he's probably hooked. He's going to wet the lips from then on before he talks. He's like the Eskimo who carries a whalebone from then on. One of the interesting little researches that was done here by Van Riper years ago. He was wondering why it was that stutters do the funny things they do when they talk. And so he simply took some histories that he called symptom histories. We had one boy here at that time in the clinic who, when he talked, he would open the mouth and stick out the tongue just as far as he could. So Van Riper asked him all the questions he could about how this began. This began with wetting the lips. He would, you know, in some situations where he was bothered and tense and nervous, the mouth would get dry, and wet the lips. And then he would talk. And unfortunately for him, he said some words after he wet the lips. And so he got in the habit of wetting the lips before he talked. And finally the tongue got out farther and farther. And that, he was doing that before he talked. So he was telling himself that's what he had to do in order to talk. So there's a relationship between the beliefs, the assumptions, the opinions that the stutter activates in what he tells himself all day long. And he acts on these things. So he does such bizarre things as sticking out his tongue in order to talk, he thinks. Well, of course, if he wouldn't stick out the tongue, he'd talk better. But he has this to learn yet. And it's to be emphasized that much of the semantic aspects of this are nonverbal. I don't need to, I think, develop that idea. Let's have the next slide. I'm not going to come anywhere near finishing this today. I don't move along a little faster. Another fact that becomes obvious and important from a semantic point of view is that the word stuttering turns out to be a multi-ordinal term, of course. And so it can be a name for a problem involving many persons, involving many things besides how you speak. It comprehensive problem. We carry the name stuttering. We use the word to refer to a problem. We use the word to refer to a category. It is a classification name. We say that something, a speaker does, is to be classified as stuttering rather than as lisping or as normal speech or something else. The word is also used as a name for certain speaking reactions or experiences which are to be specified and are not usually. The word is just used as though everybody knew what the word refers to when it is used. And of course there is tremendous variation on this level. Now this is, when you use the word to refer to speaking experiences or reactions, behaviors, you're using it as though it were a useful descriptive term. And of course it isn't. Let's have the next slide, please. The word, the levels of meaning of this word can be further indicated, perhaps in this way. What is it to be distinguished from? The word stuttering is to be differentiated from the word disfluency. And if you don't do that, I think the whole discussion becomes a hopeless muddle. Because these two words are not equivalent by any means. Everybody speaks this fluently. But only something like 7/10 of 1% of the population manage to get themselves involved in a stuttering problem. These two terms are not at all the same meaning. The word, as we use them, the word stuttering is a name for a classification category of which is a little more abstract in certain ways. More is left out. There is less said when you use this word. You don't refer to as much in detail. And it has also more of an evaluational importance. It is a highly charged word, negatively charged. The word disfluency is also a classification word, but on a somewhat lower level of abstracting. You are a little closer to what you are talking about. You are not including as much. It is not an emotionally charged word, evaluation charged word to any great degree. It's a rather neutral sort of a classification. And you go down to a lower level and you can describe, you use words like repeating and hesitating to describe the behavior that you are classifying as disfluency. And finally, you demonstrate. You give an extensional definition, you see, of what you mean. And when you do this sort of thing, you clarify the problem we call stuttering considerably. And if you don't do it, you leave it very complex, very mysterious. If you don't differentiate this fluency from stuttering, for example. And people find this hard to do. They think, well, do you mean by stuttering that there are just certain kinds of disfluencies? Well, not so much that. Although that is part of it, when you get done with your analysis, you find that some kinds of disfluency are more often classified as stuttering. But that isn't what is really the most important part of the story. What is most important is the differentiation you make in terms of the levels of abstracting. Stuttering is a word used almost always on a higher level of abstracting than disfluency. And it has come to have attached to it, because of the way we use it, certain meanings which don't belong with for the word disfluency. Meanings with regard to how the person feels about the disfluency, so on, and how others feel about it. If you don't make that differentiation, then you are likely to do what is being done repeatedly by people who publish in the journals in our field. They report what they call experiments on stuttering. And when you read the articles, what they are about is disfluency. As, for example, the kind of speech produced by delayed auditory feedback. You know, if you talk, as in the echo effect. The fellow had some of this happen to him out at the Dad's Day game when he was introducing the Dad of the Year. It's the association kept coming back. And you can rig this up in a laboratory very easily through earphones. So you delay hearing what you have just said by, say, 0.2 seconds or so. And you get this kind of speech. It's hard to go forward. And the investigators who do this call this stuttering. And this just clutters up the literature hopelessly. This isn't stuttering at all. This is disfluency of a certain kind. And actually, stutterers, we've done some research on this with stutterers. They do what other people do on that. But they say that what they're doing while that is going on is not stuttering. It is very important to make this distinction. I've been accused of saying that stuttering has no organic basis whatever. And then people go on to talk about various brain damage cases they've seen who do, as they say, stutter. I've seen them too. I'm developing a differential diagnosis to differentiate them from East Hall stutterers. You find this fluency associated with almost every possible kind of factor, from brain damage to the third highball, and fatigue, and discouragement. Lots of factors are related to disfluency. But that disfluency is very different from stuttering. Let's have the next slide. The stuttering, what the behavior that we call stuttering. Now, you must understand there is no piece of stuttering in the Bureau of Standards in Washington. So that you can go and match an example of something and you want to decide whether it is that or not. It isn't that kind of a situation. What we're dealing with here is a kind of a shifting consensus. And we deal with this a very great deal, not only in dealing with this kind of problem. We deal with this in, for instance, politics. There is no chunk of liberalism or conservatism in the Bureau of Standards in Washington that you can compare your sentiments with. To find out, are you really conservative? Are you really liberal? It isn't that kind of a problem. We're dealing with a shifting consensus. And if you say certain things, then a certain proportion of any audience will label you conservative. And if you say other things, a certain percentage will label you liberal. But at the same time, part of the audience is labeling you liberal, another proportion of that audience is also labeling you conservative. In the back of People in Quandaries, in the appendix, you'll find some of George Gallup's data that I analyzed from exactly that point of view. And I think you'll find it very interesting to read now as the election is coming up. Back in those days, if you had said that we need a conservative in the White House, you could have meant anybody from Harry Hopkins to Herbert Hoover. And Herbert Hoover was a liberal, to 5% of the voters Gallup interviewed. Of course, you're too young to know whether Herbert Hoover was a liberal or not for you, but he was probably, it's a little hard to say, this is the nearest I'm going to come to saying anything about politics. I don't think it's fair for me to take advantage of you in that way. But we will probably disagree a very great deal about just exactly where to put Goldwater on any given day on the continuum. But as I would put him on it, on the average Goldwater day and the average Johnson day, Hoover was a little bit to the right of him. But to 5% of the voters, he was a liberal. So that's what you're dealing with here, that kind of a problem. You're dealing with the language behavior of the people. It isn't going to help you really to look in the dictionary. There's nothing in the Bureau of Standards that'll help you. You're just going to have to pay attention to what people appear to mean by the words they use, what they seem to be referring to. Now, you'll get some degree of agreement about whether or not a given person at a given instant is doing what is to be called stuffing. If you sample people generally with a tape recording, that degree of agreement is going to run around 38% of what it would be if it were perfect. So you see, it's not very good. But you can get two experimenters to work in a laboratory together until they almost always agree. And that shouldn't surprise anybody. In Salem, it was possible, back 300 years ago, whenever it was, to get people to agree that somebody was a witch. You got a high agreement. It doesn't mean much. You can get high agreement on almost anything if you work at it. But if we take what agreement we have to live with, and we take those examples where people agree, and where the speaker himself tells you, what I was just doing there was what I would call stuttering. Then it turns out that what he seems to be doing is something that can be summarized by saying he is trying to avoid what to him means stuttering. Trying to avoid that happening again, as he would say. He thinks of it as something that happens. Or if he thinks of it as something he does, he's trying to keep from doing it again. But he usually thinks of it as something that happens, and if he will do the right things, it won't happen. And so the behavior that you see him performing, that you very occasionally see me performing here, I would tell you, the next time I do it, I'll tell you that I think I'm doing. You may not agree with it. And then who's right? Nobody's right. We just differ. This is avoidant behavior. It is learned. The stutter learns to expect trouble and he learns to try to avoid it. The next slide. You can put it in a more positive way. Stuttering is what the speaker does, trying to speak while also doing things that interfere with the speaking he's trying to do. He's being careful, so he's holding the breath. But he's trying to talk at the same time. If all he were trying to do were to hold the breath, that takes no energy. It's easy to hold the breath for a little while. He's being careful, so he doesn't want to go ahead yet. He might stutter if he does, so he stops. And you can stop the activity of the muscles involved in speaking most easily by holding the lips together, by pressing the tongue against the roof of the mouth or back of the teeth, or by tensing some of the muscles which control the vocal cords and act as it acts as a valve so that you shut off the air and hold the breath. And those are the ways that you manage to stop. So you often see a stutterer holding the lips together but trying to talk at the same time. And so he's trying to overcome this resistance that he feels. And he doesn't appear to know that he is making the resistance he's trying to overcome. He's talking as though he were two people. One of them wants to talk, the other wants to wait a while. So he holds the lips together real hard and tries real hard to talk. Well, you try it, and you'll do just what he does. And so that's what's there. I'm doing it. And I'm trying to talk at the same time. See, you learn these things very well. I used to do this just so much that I did much more stopping than going. But it is possible to learn to go most of the time. But these little things that you used to do, you still do once in a while. I don't know whether I have said this to you. I think it makes a point very beautifully. I've been asked whether I think I will ever get over my stuttering completely, and my answer is very simple. I say, yes, I will, but I don't think many of the listeners will. I'm over it, but some of my listeners aren't over it. For them, it's still a problem. Let's have the next slide. You have seen this before, the generalized diagram of problem involving interactions between, in this case, between the disfluencies of the speaker, which range from very few to very many, or very little or very much, the listener reactions, which range from utterly paying no attention to them to reacting to them as though they were very important and very bad and something should be done about them. And the speaker's reactions to his own disfluency and to the listener's reactions to his disfluency. And this can range from utter indifference or not even noticing to being very bothered. Now, this is the problem. Then it has these dimensions, and it has many members. It has a speaker, and it has many listeners. We're all members of the problem. Now, we've already been through this general way of talking about a problem. So let's go to the next slide. Time's running out. By the way, next time you're going to have a wonderful lecture by Dave Novak about art. I think you will simply just be fascinated. Yeah, he's going to have slides showing you various kinds of paintings, and we will talk about these in reference to what is the art. Here again, then, was the last slide we had yesterday. Let me say just a little about this with regard to this specific kind of problem. The way you deal with the problem depends upon Which dimension of it seems to be the more important at the time? Which member of the problem is the most important? And while the speaker is very young, you will never work with him. He is not the member of the problem to whom you will give your attention. You'll give your attention to some other member of the problem, usually the parents. You may include some of the teachers. You may possibly have to include the grandmothers and an older brother. But you will deal with people other than the speaker, because they are the ones who have the problem. The speaker doesn't have the problem. He will get it from them in time. If they keep on reacting to him as though the way he were talking is bad and he shouldn't do that, he'll begin to be more careful. And he'll try to wait a while he's trying to talk too. And pretty soon he'll be doing the things that you see stutterers do who are confirmed stutterers. Now, afterwards he becomes, if the problem persists, then the speaker eventually becomes the most important member of the problem. And he is the one you deal with. But in any case, you will begin, as I indicated yesterday, whether you begin with the speaker or with the mother or father or the teacher, you'll begin here and you will listen while they tell you what the problem is. And then you will try to direct the listener to do things when the child talks or in general that will make a difference to the child so that he will talk more easily to them if there is a problem yet in the way the child talks. There may not be, but there may be. And even if there is, you don't work with the child until the child has taken on the problem to such a degree that SR reaction dimension has become so important that it is interfering, it is playing a role that is very important. And then when you work with him, you begin here also, and you find out what to him is the problem and what can he do that will be different. And with either of them, you're probably going to have to do a little teaching, a little reorienting, giving them a little more awareness of the role they're playing through their language behavior, and a little information about the learning that is going on and the factors affecting it. And then they can talk about the problem more intelligently. And they can understand what they're telling themselves about it a little more effectively. And so you keep going until again you end up with the behavior change. You don't end up being happy that you're a stutterer. But not ideally, as I would do. See you Monday.